the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Got a full week, and we're done with overviews. So we're just going to...
That was so much fun.
Start right in. Today we have three bills. Chris, you're probably doing all three, I would guess.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Since they fall into right into... So let's... if we could do 179 first, since we have a panel in from McMinnville, and we'll try to get to their bill first. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 179. Chris.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 179 requires that multi-state insurer apportionment formula factors that are less than zero be set to zero, and that factors that do not exist be excluded from the apportionment formula. The bill also authorizes insurance companies to petition the Department of Revenue and allows the department to use a modified apportionment formula if the current formula does not produce fair and equitable apportionment. Potential modifications include the exclusion of any one or more factors, the inclusion of one or more additional factors, the inclusion of reinsurance premiums in the insurance sales factor, or any other method to achieve a fair and equitable apportionment of the taxpayer's income. And the draft revenue impact is estimated to be a minimal impact and less than $50,000 per year.
Great. Questions for Mr. Hollenbach? And do we have anyone signed up to testify, Paul?
We do.
And while we wait, just to let everyone know, Paul lost a bet to me on Saturday night, and so I'll be looking forward to an overtime bet.
Oh.
Okay, so let's have Deborah, if we could have you come first, just to set the table, and then we'll get to our panel from Oregon Mutual.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, up until mid-90s, the insurance companies paid a tax on gross premiums rather than the corporate excise tax. And it was at that time that the insurance companies were transitioned over to using the corporate excise tax like regular corporations do. But rather than just dumping them into the same treatment that applies to regular corporations, some of the factors were, or features of the premiums tax were retained in the new structure. You have a handout in your packet that explains what those factors are. Insurance sales is one which kind of corresponds to the sales factor. Wages and commissions that corresponds to the payroll factor. The third factor is real estate income and interest, which you might think of as corresponding to the property factor. Some of the issues that we've found since we started administering this as an excise tax are explained in this bill and addressed. One is that third factor, the real estate income and interest factor, because you're taking income and subtracting expenses from that, could potentially end up as a negative factor. You wouldn't normally think of a property factor as being able to be negative. And what we have done in practice is if we see a negative factor, we have set that to zero in processing the return. This bill would make clear that if you do end up with a negative factor, that would be zero. Also, the law is not entirely clear as to how you apportion the income if one of the factors is totally non-existent in the business. For example, if an insurance company does not have any real estate income and interest at all, whether in Oregon or elsewhere, does it make sense to use three factors to apportion, or should be using just the two factors that actually exist in the business, which has been our practice. If one is totally gone, we have used two factors, logically thinking that when they're totally absent, what you're requiring is division by zero, which from our old math days is not defined. So one thing I remember from our old math days. The third issue addressed in the bill is that for regular or normal corporations, there is a provision in the law that allows either the taxpayer or the department to use an alternative to the statutory provisions for apportioning income. Unfortunately, that does not exist in the insurance tax statutes. And on the last two pages of the handout, you have an excerpt from the Stonebridge Life Insurance Company order that was issued early in 2006. in that particular case, the court found that using the statutory factors resulted in an unconstitutional tax on that particular taxpayer because it was about 1,800% more than even just looking at their income and multiplying that by the corporate tax. So they had a finding that that was unconstitutional, but they found nothing in the law that allowed either the court or the department to do anything different than what is in the law. So the third issue that's addressed is putting in an alternative method that either the taxpayer or the department could use to get to a tax that fairly represents their business activity in Oregon. So those are the three things that are addressed in the bill, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Deborah. Questions for Ms. Buchanan? Thank you.
Thank you.
If you could, I'm sure you would anyway, but stand by. We might have questions. Steve Patterson, not the president of the Portland Trailblazers, Ed Porty, or Yorty?
Yorty.
Yorty, I'm sorry. And she has elected not to join the panel. So this is our Oregon Mutual panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Members, my name is Steve Patterson. I'm Vice President and General Counsel of Oregon Mutual Insurance Company in McMinnville. And with me is Ed Yorty, our Vice President and Treasurer. And we're here on behalf of Oregon Mutual today in opposition of Senate Bill 179. I would say that as of last spring, the department did have some discussions with Oregon Mutual, and we do appreciate that they invited us in for some input, but the bill does not reflect what we think is the best message to send to Oregon businesses. In preparing for today, I would note that I read the business section of the Oregonian last Friday and know that you've been dealing with some kicker tax measures and such, and that the economist, Mr. Romero, was here, said that really one of your challenges was to increase revenue while continuing to encourage businesses to do business in Oregon. We're here today, and it's not because it's a huge amount of money in the overall scheme, but it's a big amount of money to Oregon Mutual to say that the current excise law in itself, but Senate Bill 179 as it's written, creates even a bigger problem. And the reason is there are three factors that go into the excise tax. One of them is the sales that are apportioned to Oregon as compared to everywhere else you sell. The other is wages you pay in Oregon and commissions as opposed to everywhere else. And then the last one is real estate income and interest as opposed to that you'd have anywhere else. For a company like Oregon Mutual, we have over 200 employees. We have a home office. We just built a brand new one in McMinnville. Our employees are housed there and throughout several communities in the state. Most of our employees are in Oregon. In fact, 85% of our wages that are paid to employees are paid as Oregon wages. Only 42% of our commissions are paid as Oregon commissions, so we're supporting independent insurance agents throughout Oregon as well. The point I would make there is, even though we sell insurance outside the state of Oregon, we're using Oregonians to service that business, and we're paying wages in Oregon for that. Now, because we own this property in Oregon, and we don't own it anywhere else, we have expense on that property that offsets a kind of a statutory accounting, I guess, fiction, I would say, which is we have imputed rent. And then you take the imputed rent you would receive from the property and buildings that you own, and then you would subtract out the expenses of it. For Oregon Mutual currently, that ends up being a negative, slightly negative number, which is then averaged to zero. I'd clear up in Ms. Buchanan's testimony, there is nothing unclear about the current state of the law. The Stonebridge case that she cited, the Court of Appeals and the Oregon Tax Court both said that neither the court nor the Department of Revenue had the ability to change the current apportionment method, which was divide by three. Didn't say if it was zero, didn't say if it was a less than zero. So you take those, whatever they add up to, and you divide it by three. The current practice of the department has been, with our zero factor, to divide by two. And in fact, Senate Bill 179 seeks to make that the law, divide by two. Here's the impact. If you take out that factor, and in the testimony I've prepared for you, there's a, I've got it marked as Exhibit A. It's the back page, I hope. This is actually a copy of our 2003 excise tax return as amended by the department and sent back to us. There's three things that I would point out to you here.
That was 2005, I'm sorry.
Several things I'd point out to you here. If you look at the top, there's some columns there. It says line description, original, and adjusted. The original is the Oregon Mutual filing. Right down in the middle of that, it says average percentage. Our average percentage was 32.5647% for our tax. That's divided by three, using all three factors. Right across from that, the adjusted, that's what the department sent back to us. 48.847 is the amended return when you divide by two. Now, in the explanation of adjustments made, the explanation is insurance companies apportion income to Oregon based upon an averaging of the following three factors. Well, we didn't have three factors averaged. We only had two factors averaged. And the difference for us before the credits, tax before credits, was almost $100,000. And after the net credits were given, it was $61,000, which ended up being a pretty sizable tax bump for us. In fact, since 1997, our returns have been, their instructions used to say you divide by two, but we've got appeals and have amended our tax filings going back to 97, and it's over $200,000. Which, again, not a huge amount in terms of overall business, but significant for a small company like Oregon Mutual. One of the concerns we have is the message this sends to companies like ours. We are the sole mutual insurance company in Oregon anymore. The other two, Sublimity and I think Physicians Mutual, have either sold or joined with out-of-state insurers. And one of the things that does is reduces their taxes in Oregon from this factor. When you take out that factor, you focus more emphasis on the number of employees, the wages that we're paying in Oregon. And so in my testimony, I also provided you with an example at the bottom of page two. This example is meant to illustrate this point. And it is basically Oregon Mutual Insurance Company with employees in Oregon and outside of employees in Oregon, all other things being equal. And I put a 2% factor for wages paid in Oregon for the out-of-state competitor on the idea they may have a claims employee, but let's suggest that they're doing direct marketing either over the Internet or by phone banks that are outsourced somewhere outside of Oregon.
Is that's common industry practice?
For to direct market?
Yeah.
Well, it's becoming more and more. We've chosen to stick with independent agencies, and there are direct writers through captive agencies. But there's a lot of companies that are moving to internet-based and call center-based sales because they're able to reduce their expenses.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see, the difference in those factors, the primary one being wages and commissions, and remember that's Oregon wages and commissions, if you do it by the current law, the difference is 16% more that we'd pay by being here paying the wages we do. If you divide it by two, as this bill suggests, that amount would actually be a disparity of 24%. Now, 7 months ago, and I won't speak for State Farm, but I used to work for State Farm, and I know they've moved jobs out of Oregon and up to Washington. And I can't help but think that that trend with some of the insurance companies is not in some way affected by the fact that there's no encouragement that they actually keep employees here, because it affects the formulas that are in the way that they're taxed. So we're here to promote, if you want to play with this law, we think the best thing to do would be to tax us like the other corporations are taxed, and do it just based on the sales factor. One factor, same for everybody. If you're out of state and you're not employing Oregonians and you have a sales element that's 50%, that's your tax rate, just like it would be for us. No disparity there. In the alternative, you should keep the three factors, make sure that it's divisible by three, because we think even zero is a moderate factor. In fact, on the way down this morning, Mr. Yorty was telling me, if we were to take our new home office building and rent out a space in it, 4 feet by 4 feet, for somebody to come sell coffee, and made enough rental income, nominal rental income, to actually turn our negative number into a positive number, that our factor for real estate income would be 100%, because we don't own any real estate anywhere else. So the current method of doing this can be tricky for a small Oregon-based company, and we don't think it's equitable. Was there anything?
Mr. Yorty?
I'm just here as moral support, and if there's any technical questions for the committee, Mr. Chairman.
The fact is, the imputed rent, some of that gets into statutory accounting, which, if you were to ask me a question about, my eyes would glaze over and we'd probably all go to sleep. But Mr. Yorty actually understands that stuff. We do agree with one thing in the bill, and that is they have made an exclusion for home office in the rental part to get rid of imputed, so you don't have to calculate and include imputed rent, which is really a fiction. We don't pay ourselves rent. We don't collect rent from ourselves. That building and the ones we house our employees in are really all expense to us until we, you know, pay them off. So they do that in a section of the bill, and we do obviously support that. But our suggestion would be to go with a single sales factor like other corporations, or to leave the current method the way it is and make sure that the department is required to divide it by three. Now, that one, I would notice at the end of this bill, they asked that this be, that they're able to apply this retroactively to tax years that can be. To me, this is a premature bill then, because Oregon Mutual has tax years that are currently being challenged. We're appealing tax years for this very reason. The court in StormGrid said that they have to divide by three. Their own instructions last year said they had to divide by three, and yet when their computer system gets zero, it kicks out that factor and divides by two. And so we've got some significant money that we're challenging now, and this bill, if it passed, would likely take away our right to seek that redress and collect those back taxes.
Do you have active litigation?
It's not litigation. It's the administrative step that we have to take first, which is we're appealing to we've amended some past year returns, and we have actually appealed our 2005 return. And that's been going on for 6 months.
To the department?
Yes, sir.
And just for clarity, the piece of property that you mentioned, that is the one piece of property that Oregon Mutual owns, is the headquarters in McMinnville.
Correct.
And Mr. Yorty, we just have to get your name and city and county for records.
We own a building in McMinnville, Oregon, and my residence is Sherwood, Oregon.
And your name is?
Edward Yorty.
Thank you. And then one other question for Chris. So, Chris, the bill is prospective in nature, other than that one section that actually has retroactive language. And does it deal just with this one case? With Oregon Mutual in terms of the retroactive language?
Mr. Chair, the language is broader than just this one company. It's Section 2, sub 2, and it refers to any tax year which is subject to audit by the Department of Revenue. Any tax year for which a return is subject to audit or adjustment by the Department of Revenue on or after the effective date of this 2007 Act.
Right. Questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you.
Deborah, I had one question from Ms. Buchanan.
Mr. Chairman, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue.
So what was the rationale for the language that Chris just read on page 3, line 1?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding, as Mr. Patterson noted, that companies have filed returns using division by two factors. I do not know with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company whether that's the case, and that's the reason that they're amending now is to divide by three. But if companies did file using two factors, the law change and this applicability would validate those filings. So those that have filed and divided by two would be correct. The other thing that I did just want to clarify, because and perhaps I misunderstood what Mr. Patterson said, was if a company has a negative factor that it's adjusted to zero, but they would still divide by three. If it's zero, but it was negative, we don't throw that out altogether. It's only when the factor is totally non-existent. That is, a company has no
real estate.
No real estate income and interest at all, that division then by two occurs. If it's negative but gets adjusted to zero, that is still an existing factor, and it would be divided by three in that case, assuming the other two factors are there.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Monroe.
Well, then, why in the case of Mutual did the department revert back to divide by two when they own real estate and it is at zero?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, I haven't seen that, but if that is actually what we did, it's my understanding that's not what the bill would provide for. So,
okay. I thought there was a disparity from her original earlier testimony and from what Mr. Patterson said. So which is it? I mean, strikes me that if they don't have any real estate at all, then it ought to be divided by two. And you're saying 179 would do that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, yes. That's my understanding.
But if they have real estate and it's at zero or negative, then you divide by three.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, assuming they have the other two factors, if the calculation of the third factor has a negative result, that would be adjusted to zero, but it would still be division by the three factors because there is some real estate income and interest in the business. It's simply that it ended up as a negative factor.
Yeah. Question for Chris.
He's jumping to get in here.
Yeah, please. I need an explanation here. Which way is it?
Senator, I think the confusion, if you look at the example that Mutual Insurance provided, which is on
page 3,
there, the real estate income and interest.
Where is that?
It's
actually page 4.
I see it. Okay, real estate income and interest, okay.
Okay, I believe the confusion is around the three factors. We have the real estate interest, real estate income and interest, the wage commission, and the insurance sales.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look on the real estate income line, you'll see that the total Oregon is zero and the total everywhere is zero.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a case where the division is not defined because you have zero divided by zero. And in this case, the department is dividing by two. As in comparison, if the total income were zero and the total everywhere were non-zero, say $10 million, then that percent would be zero and the department would divide by three factors. So the real question is the everywhere factor. When the everywhere factor, the everywhere part of one of the factors is zero.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Then that would only apply to an Oregon company. If mm-hmm. they. So that's one. Okay, that makes sense to me.
Does that help? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a real problem if we are, in effect, punishing our local companies vis-a their foreign competitors. If that's, in fact, what the tax law does, either before or after 179, then we need to take a careful look at that. And I think we ought to be encouraging homegrown businesses and not taxing them inordinately compared to their out-of-state competitors.
Yeah, you know, this one case is, I think, at least brings about the question of if Oregon Mutual is the only company, and is that correct, Mr. Buchanan, that really falls into this type of apportionment formula, not just the bill itself, but this type of apportionment formula? Are there many others out of state that that would fall in? I don't know how.
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to staff on that question, if you don't mind.
I would need to do a little more digging to find out if this was the only company that's affected this way.
Just it brings about kind of Senator Monroe's concern in mind, too, of why we have a section just dealing with unique situations like the Oregon Mutual situation. And Ms. Buchanan, so was this legislation precipitated by this one case, or just in the interim the department was looking at kind of ambiguity within the statutes, and this was a clear example of ambiguity?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that in looking at the statute and the way the department has applied the law, there were questions as to whether or not, if you had a negative factor, whether that should be adjusted to zero, whether if a factor is totally non-existent, you should be dividing by that factor, and then also primarily the case in early 2006 with the unconstitutional application of the statute. We knew we needed to get that fixed. So in bringing that forward, we looked at the other issues and said it would be good to clarify what the legislature intends to do with those, how they want to have that law applied to the insurance companies.
Great. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't agree more with the questions that have been asked. And one of the questions I have is that if we're down to one company now, if that is what it is, and a company was thinking about saying, I'm going to put my home office in Oregon because I love the beautiful country and all that sort of stuff. Okay. But I'm also looking at a beautiful area, basically the same valley up at the Port of Calama. And we all know what the tax advantage is. If you were in that insurance company, where would you go?
They'd take what they pay the B&O tax in Calama?
That's a rhetorical question.
Chairman, yes.
Would they pay Washington's B&O tax?
Chairman, I don't know how insurance companies in Washington are treated. I can only assume that there would be some tax that's going to apply to a business that's in Washington. But, Senator George, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I understand your question, and I do take that as being rhetorical in nature, but I think the same discussions occurred around adoption of the single sales factor. It was the same type of thing. Do you want to, in some cases, it was portrayed as punishing companies that invest in property or payroll in Oregon rather than providing them an incentive. So I think it's somewhat similar to that discussion. It's a policy discussion for you. We will do whatever it is you want, whatever you direct us to do. It's just that we have looked at the words and said, this is what we think they mean, and that has led to some issues. So we're here to have that clarified as to what policy you want to have us administer.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
Continuing the rhetoric, I don't think we can afford to send that kind of message. I really don't. That there's a good chance that if you're housed here, if this is home, it might cost you. So I hope that's the basis of what we do with this.
Appreciate the thoughts. I'm losing my question. I had one other.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Monroe,
just a brief comment. Washington does have a sizable B&O tax that Oregon doesn't have. So, depending on what kind of company you have, you may pay more taxes in Washington than you do in Oregon.
Now I got my question. So thank you for the good debate there. Now I'm looking. Oh, here it is. All timers come so quickly. It comes and goes. So now, a company like Oregon Mutual, they start their appeals process. Could you walk us through, the committee through, how they would begin to appeal a situation like this or Company X, and if they wanted to continue along after they go to the department?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I will try. The company might answer their particular situation better than I can. But if as I understand it, returns were filed and took a particular position as to how income should be apportioned. Following the filing of the original return, amended returns were filed that in some way changed the method by which income was apportioned. The department would get the return, look at it, and either agree or disagree with the position taken on the amended return. If we believed that the law wasn't being applied correctly, we would issue a notice of proposed refund denial saying, no, we don't agree, and we are not sending back the refund. The company would then have the opportunity to ask for a conference with the department and come in and present their case to the conference officer. The conference officer makes the decision. The company can then appeal that result to the Oregon Tax Court, either the magistrate division or the regular division of the court, and it would go up through the court process.
And that's the standard procedure.
As I understand it, that's the general procedure for
how these cases are.
Right. Involving an amended return after an original has been filed.
After an original. Other questions for Ms. Buchanan? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sean Miller, Oregon Property Casualty Insurance Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association. We represent over 200 property and casualty insurance companies here in Oregon, and Oregon Mutual is a good member of the association, as well as some of the members that were referred to in the earlier testimony, such as Geico, Progressive, some of your direct writing companies who are out-of-state, multi-state insurers that obviously write insurance here in Oregon, and to support Oregon Mutual's problems with the bill. They are our Oregon company, and they're the only company that I've heard from so far that has significant problems with the legislation. A lot of the out-of-state companies that, when this was distributed in the interim, when we met with the Department of Revenue, haven't given me any impact or has impacted their companies, and so I just wanted to go on record in supporting our Oregon company. And as of today, the only one that I know that has a significant impact from the bill. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer, but I just wanted to get that on the record that I have not heard from some of the other companies, even some of the companies that have significant presence in Oregon, such as Liberty Northwest, that also does write business in probably every state as well. And so it is a concern to Oregon Mutual, and so it is a concern to us as well. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Questions for Sean? Yeah, Senator George.
Sean, if we have a real estate income issue, and the factor is three, why wouldn't we say if it's zero, it'd be three anyway? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, that's the way I think we interpret how they should be doing it today under the Court of Appeals case. And so, I think the question is do you want to take that away and have it apply to the two factors? And so, understanding Oregon Mutual's concern with their property that they own, and they just built a very nice building, and as you know, put a significant amount of investment in the city of McMinnville. Those kind of companies are important to Oregon, and we obviously want to support that.
Senator Monroe?
Well, but we heard the department say that under cases like Oregon Mutual, they would divide by three. Oregon Mutual says no, they're being required to only divide by two. So we need an answer, Chris, and I'm not ready to move on this bill until we get that answer.
Other questions or comments? Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Oregon Mutual, anything you've heard the discussion, anything you'd like to leave us with before we...
Mr. Chairman, Member Steve Patterson with Oregon Mutual, and I thank you for your questions and your concerns. I think a couple things. The bill is written. I talked about the fact that we favored sort of removing the imputed rent. But if you did that, then we wouldn't have a factor over time when we stop paying on the building. I mean, if they remove imputed rent, we have no rental income. So we have no factor there, which means we'd be dividing by two under their rule.
Okay.
And so that would be an impact. Secondly, whether it's the intention of the department, and I'm certainly not going to say that it is their intention, I think it's probably a computer program that's not doing it right. Our 2005 amended return.
Amended or?
No, our initial return was filed with the division by three. I gave you page three of our amended return, which they sent back to us. I think you can see from the math that it was divided by two.
Mm-hmm.
And so the last thing I would say is anything, and I mean this with the, I guess, most delicate respect for the good people at the Department of Revenue that are doing their job, but we amended returns back in June of this year, sent them in. I checked in October when we started the appeal process for our 2005 return, which we got back and you saw. At that time, I asked for the status of the returns we amended, and they had been lost, or they had no record that they had them. I've sent them twice. I still don't have a status. From our standpoint, it feels like we're in a four-corner drill, seeing if we can pass a bill that's going to justify the division by two. And I guess four corners is a great thing, but it's hurting the home team. We got some significant money wrapped up in the taxes we pay and the people we employ, and all those employees are paying taxes in Oregon too. So I do appreciate the members' questions and the concern for an Oregon company, and I just want to make sure we cleared that up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Patterson, Beaverton High School graduate. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Go appreciated Beavs. The four corners analogy. Okay, anyone else on Senate Bill 179? Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 179. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 178. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 178 clarifies language pertaining to the definition of a unitary business. Current statute states that a unitary business is a business that, either directly or indirectly, shares or exchanges value as demonstrated by A, centralized management or common executive force, B, centralized administrative services or functions resulting in economies of scale, and C, flow of goods, capital resources, or services demonstrating functional integration. The Department of Revenue has interpreted the statute to mean all three conditions as being necessary. This bill would modify that interpretation to mean that not all three conditions had to be met to define define a business as unitary.
Any questions for Chris? Ms. Buchanan.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 178 comes to you to make some changes in the law regarding the apportionment of income. You heard last week from staff about how corporations use the formula to apportion income when they have business in several states. And the focus at that time seemed to be on the factors that are used in that formula, the property factor, the sales factor, and the payroll factor. This bill looks at the other component of that formula, which is the income piece, and gives guidance to businesses as to how they determine the amount of income that goes into that calculation. In 1984, this statute was adopted. That is shown on the testimony that I provided. And we have, since that time, had a rule on the books that said, in looking at whether or not a single trade or business exists, we will look at all of these factors as being necessary to make that determination. What has happened since then is that the Multi-State Tax Commission has issued uniform regulations. They did that in 2004. That indicate that even if not all of these factors are present, a unitary business could exist. Other things that have changed since that time, the nature of business has changed. We're not so much in a manufacturing environment, but service businesses are becoming more prevalent. And in some cases, service businesses might not be able to meet one of these criteria. So under the current law, we believe that we would have the ability to adopt the multi-state tax commission regulations that also are in this packet starting on page 3. But we did want to bring this issue to the legislature because of the legislative history involved and what we explained 20 years ago as to how we would interpret this statute. On page 2, you see the rule that was in place as to how we would define what constitutes a single trade or business or a unitary business. The new rule at the bottom of that page was adopted on January 1 and simply says that even though not all three factors are present, it could be a unitary business. That's also consistent with a court decision from the Oregon Tax Court, which is in your packet beginning on page 11 with Maytag Corporation. In that particular case, the tax court found that there was a unitary business, even though it did not find that one of the particular factors was present for that business. So again, what we're asking for is a statutory changing the term single trade or business to a unitary business, and then also clarifying by changing the word and to or that not all of these factors must be present in order for a unitary business to exist. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Ms. Buchanan?
The Chair?
Yeah, Senator Burke.
Just so I understand, what it sounds to me like this bill would be putting into effect something that the court has already said is the case.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the court did in 1993 issue a ruling that a business was unitary, even though it did not find the presence of all of these factors. In fact, I believe in that case it specifically found that there was no functional integration. So that was one of the tests for unity that it did not find, yet it did find that it was operating as a single trader business. So the short answer is yes, Senator Burdick, it would conform to that court decision.
Well, to follow up, Mr. Chair,
please.
If that was 1993, how come we're just now dealing with this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I don't believe that the practice of the department is necessarily going to change even if this statute changes and the rule is adopted. In trying to determine whether or not unity exists for a group of corporations, we are still going to be looking at as many factors as we can find to support the case that unity exists. The court decision and our rule did not change because we were still looking for all of the factors in doing our work, our audit work. We felt it was important if the company wanted to litigate that we try to find as many factors as possible. The regulations, though, that the Multi-State Tax Commission issued clearly state that it's not necessary that all three of these exist, and we felt that it was important if we wanted to proceed with adopting those regulations that we come to you and say we explain how we would interpret this statute in 1984. Adoption of this rule would be a different policy, and we wanted to make you aware of that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On the ground, are any businesses going to be paying more taxes than they were before if this bill passes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it is possible that some corporations will pay more. It is possible that some corporations would pay less because in looking at the unity of a group of corporations, if a corporation now is not part of the unitary group because of a finding that one factor is not there, they are excluded, so their income would not come into the group and not be apportioned. On the other hand, if that corporation is a loss corporation, excluding it from the base under the current excluding it from the base means that the company pays more. If that loss corporation is able to come in,
then they pay less tax. So there would be winners and losers if, even if you look at it and say fewer than three factors are required. And in fact, we have had companies that have argued that this corporation should be part of the unitary group because it is a loss corporation and they would pay less tax. And in one case, we did look at that and say, because we cannot verify that all of these factors are met, it wasn't able to be a part of that unitary group.
Mr. Chair. Senator Starr. I'm not sure, though, that you answered Senator Burke's question about 1993 and 2007. Is there, what's the rationale for bringing this to us now? What problem or shattering problem are we trying to fix by passing this bill?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Starr and Senator Burdick, the case was decided in 1993, but it dealt with years that were prior to the law change in 1984 and years after that. So it did span a period of time when the law changed. And I don't think it was exactly clear to us that the it would be necessary for us to change our rule based on that court case. I think what gave us greater impetus was when additional cases came down in other states, plus the Multi-State Tax Commission issued the regulations to define what is meant by these words. And in looking at that, we felt that it was important to come here and say, you have adopted a policy of following multi-state tax uniformity proposals. We have many of them in the statutes. Here is another one. It is a bit contrary to what our rule had been and what the legislative testimony was in 1984 when you adopted the statute. Is that the policy that you would like for us to pursue by adopting those regulations?
Just a quick follow-up. So then really the real impetus here is not the court case, but really it's about common language across the states so that businesses that are doing business in multi-states terms all mean the same and they can do their accounting and all that across the board and from one state to another have common terms.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I think that is a very important part of it, yes. It does, because we are part of the multi-state tax compact and we do joint audits and we adopt uniform proposals and we try to have that uniformity among the states, that it is important that when possible we follow and adopt those regulations to provide that uniform treatment.
And that commission, my memory is relatively recent.
Mr. Chairman, the Multi-State Tax Commission actually was formed in 1967.
Well, recent for some of us.
So it has been there for quite some time.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah. I thought I heard you say that 178 essentially codifies your existing practice.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, our practice since adoption of the statute was to look for and require that each of these factors, A, B, and C, be present in order to find that a group of corporations operates as a single trader business. So the statutory change in Senate Bill 178 is different. It says not all of these factors must be present in order to find that there is a single trader business that's operating.
Yes, I understand that. But I thought I heard you say that you did not necessarily require that they meet all of the criteria in order to be classified as a unitary business.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, our practice has been and our rule has reflected that we do require that all of these factors be present in order to find that there is a unitary group. So perhaps I misstated something.
Okay, so 178 will in fact change your current practice.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, Senate Bill 178 would authorize us to adopt regulations that would be a change in practice for us. We did change our rule effective January 1, 2007, and you see that on page 2, to say that not all of these factors must be present. So we have changed the rule under current law to say that not all of the factors must be present. What we're here to say is this is a policy change from what we explained to the legislature when you adopted the rule in the statute in 1984. And we wanted to confirm with you that you are comfortable with that policy change. If you are, the language change that Senate Bill 178 makes would clearly state that not all of the factors must be present, and then we feel that we would be authorized at that point to go ahead and adopt the multi-state tax commission regulations.
So you already changed your rules as of the 1st of January, and now you're asking us to codify what you have already done.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, we're asking you to clarify in the statute that that is an acceptable policy for you. We believe that under the law, as it's written now, there is authority, and the court case, there is authority to say not all factors are required. What we want to tell you is that is a policy change from what we told the legislature in 1984, and we want to make sure that you're comfortable with that policy change.
Okay. And the net effect of us not passing this bill might mean additional litigation, additional court battles over whether or not you had acted, your rule change as of the 1st of January was proper.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, I assume that would be the case if I were a business and looking at the rule change and aware of the legislative testimony from 1984, I would argue that the department is doing something that it should not be doing.
Okay.
Even, yes.
Thank you.
Do you know how many states, so I'm reading quickly this multi-state tax commission, and it says insert your state statute here, and I'm gathering that it was the January 15th, 2004 is when this language was drafted. Do you know how many states have adopted this language?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know, but I can try to get that information for you.
Just another, just general question, not Senate Bill 179 specific. We heard earlier, and I think lost is a loaded term, but that taxpayers had contacted the department about their tax filings and were told they didn't have the information, the department didn't have the, or couldn't find the information. Is that common, or?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe it's common. I cannot say it does not happen. We're a large organization, but I will go back and try to figure out exactly what's going on with that and where the returns are.
Just seems amazing or surprising that we couldn't find the tax information. I'm sure they must have had copies, but I think it just caught all of our attention.
It caught my attention, Mr. Chair.
Great. Any other questions for Ms. Buchanan? Thank you very much, Deborah. Boy Scout Troop 288 is no longer, they're all doing good things, taking
little ladies across the street.
That's right, even though there's a great crosswalk. Yes, Senator Starr.
Do we know what's causing this microphone to ring like that? Are we doing something wrong?
I don't know. Is it just this hearing room? We definitely.
I believe that they have turned the sound way up to catch our round table, and maybe they haven't adjusted it.
Well, I'll buy that explanation. Okay, so do we want to hold on 178? We'll hold it for and get some of that information in terms of how many other states, and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 178. Okay. Open public hearing on Senate Bill 176. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 176 allows the transfer of outstanding liability for taxes, penalty, or interest from a business entity that dissolves to a reorganized entity that is substantially the same business. The bill specifies factors that may be considered when determining if the dissolved and reorganized businesses are essentially the same. The factors include the physical location of the businesses, the services provided or products produced by the businesses, if the businesses have the same corporate directors or officers, or if the businesses have the same owners or holders of a direct or indirect interest in the businesses. And this one does have a revenue impact of about $100,000 a year. There's an initial impact of $200,000 a year, and that is for some outstanding cases at the Department of Revenue where the collection activities have hit a wall, so to speak, in these cases.
And less than for local government, less than 50 for local government, if I'm reading that correctly.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This affects a variety of tax programs. Income taxes, withholding taxes are the largest piece of that, but it also affects tobacco taxes and transit taxes. And tobacco taxes are a piece of the other funds, and the transit taxes are the local government. That would be the Lane Transit and TriMet.
And TriMet. Great. Questions for Chris as we bob to from the microphone. Ms. Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Senate Bill 176 is fairly simple. It authorizes the department, when it has determined that a business owes tax and hasn't paid the tax, to transfer that tax liability to a new entity if it determines that the business simply shut down, opened up again a week or so later, a month later, same assets, same owners, same business, same property, yet a new corporate entity. Under current law, we cannot take the debt that would the old business would owe and transfer it to the new business. We need to start all over with our process and our assessments and our determinations. So this would allow the transfer of that debt to the new business and allow us to proceed with collection efforts against that business. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so it has a net revenue of $100,000. So that means there must be cases that we know about out there where the department is going after the prior business's debt. But a new organization has been formed, and so I assume the department or LRO believes that once we talk to the new entity, that will clear up their debt that they owe the state.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that it will clear up the debt, but it will allow us at least to say this is your debt, new business, where under current law we can't. The debt would stay with the old business, and then with the new business there's no debt there to try to collect against the assets that they have.
Mm-hmm.
So this simply says you're running the same business, you're trying to get out of the tax, you've got these assets that you had in the old business, we're going to be looking at those assets to collect this debt.
Can you talk about the cases? Are you restricted in terms of names and...
Mr. Chairman, I'm guessing I probably cannot talk about them. I don't have personal knowledge of the cases. I do know that we have some in the cigarette tax program. We have seen some there where people will set up a tobacco shop or a cigarette shop and not pay the taxes on the other tobacco products. We try to collect it and continue, and all of a sudden it's shut down and a new corporation forms and it's just up and running again with the same people, the same assets, and we're not able to transfer the debt.
So what happens in those cases? You just hang on to the old debt and go after that? And
well, if that business doesn't exist anymore, if the assets have been transferred to the new one, there's nothing in the old one to try to get a hold of, so we start over with the new one and go through the process, and when they don't pay the tax there for 6 months or a year, then we're trying to collect that debt, and they're shutting down and starting up another one. So it's just a trail of unpaid tax.
Okay. Questions? Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you. This doesn't require a business to file bankruptcy. It's just dissolving a corporate structure and constituting a new one.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I'm not even sure that the corporation would need to dissolve. I think that what could happen and does happen is that they simply set up a new corporation and transfer the assets on paper to the new corporation. Maybe the old one's just is just a shell and sits there and doesn't do anything, but the new one now is off and running with the business. So I believe there are businesses that have been pretty adept at figuring out how to make this work for them.
Hmm. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
There's one thing that makes legitimate people that pay their taxes mad. It's when other people get away with a scam like this. I think this is a bill we need to move.
Deborah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You get put in the middle of...
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Starr.
Is this bill retroactive in any way? Or is it prospective, looking forward? So you've mentioned some cases, tobacco shops or whatnot. Would this allow the department to go back? We pass this bill, it becomes effective the 91st day after sine die, I think.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I do not see anything in the bill that restricts us to it would be my understanding that if a business that exists today after the effective date of the Act transfers its assets to a new business, we would take the position, I believe, that we could take the debt that applies to the old business and transfer it to the new business.
As of 91st
day. As of the 91st day, yes. Thank you.
I see, yeah. Other questions for, yes, Senator Monroe?
Well, it's too bad we can't go after those those in the past, but there's a little constitutional matter of ex post facto laws, so I think probably the best we can do is make sure it doesn't happen in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? We have a letter from Lane Barlow. I'm not sure if he's here. Or anyone else who would like to testify on what bill is this? Senate Bill 176. Closed public hearing. Got two members that aren't here. Seems pretty straightforward to me.
I'll move it if you want.
The great thing about this March is gives us plenty of time to for bills just hang out there. Okay, so we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 176.
I would move Senate Bill 176 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved Senate Bill 176 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. So, Senator Burdick, we are in a work session about to move Senate Bill 176. And Senator Monroe just made a motion.
Okay.
To move the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Barbara, maybe we'll call the roll and timing is everything. So, Senator George, we are in a work session preparing to move Senate Bill 176. A motion has been made to move that bill.
Okay.
If you would like a moment.
Okay. I'm fine. All right. Just a little bit ago.
Sure. Barbara can call the roll since we have people kind of coming in.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Votes aye.
Vice Chair George.
Aye.
Who told me?
Senator
votes aye. The motion passes, and Senator Monroe, you have a great deal of passion, which is always helpful.
Love to carry this.
Carrying bills like this. Okay, so with that, I think we've held two bills, passed one, and we'll be back here tomorrow at 8:40 for hopefully, we'll definitely have a couple more bills and perhaps less controversy. We are adjourned.